Bid you a good evening. Let's take our Bibles and turn to Jeremiah, the 12th chapter. Jeremiah chapter 12 is where we had left off. And we'll pick up again. Now, just to reiterate, Jeremiah had been informed of a conspiracy against his life. And surprisingly, it was from his own hometown. Some of the men of his hometown had tried to formulate a plan to take his life. And God said that he would turn the tables on them. But Jeremiah is questioning God's timing in all of this. He doesn't doubt that God is who God says he is. He doesn't doubt God's character or God's justice. It's probably more a question of timing. And so in chapter 12:1, he says, "Righteous are you, O Lord, when I plead with you. Yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them. Yes, they have taken root. They grow. Yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind." And we had studied Psalm 73 in conjunction with this very thing to see that it is it is not isolated to Jeremiah or even Asaph, as we saw in Psalm 73. But even ourselves sometimes can feel that the wicked seem to prosper when the righteous seem to be persecuted or to suffer trial. And we see that Asaph said he had started to think that way until he considered their end and in comparison to our end. And it was a different comparison. Job's another one. Job 21's another reference where Job also in the midst of his suffering. Remember, Job was a righteous man, blameless in all of his conduct. And then yet he began to suffer tremendously. And he considered then the wicked. He just seemed to be so happy. And he couldn't understand God's dealings with all of this. It was an enigma to him. And an enigma here even to Jeremiah. And so we talked about this question. Why does it feel like that the wicked are rewarded? And we kind of slightly ran out of time on that. So I said we'd bring it up again if anyone else wanted to contribute to that discussion or add to it. Now's a good time to do that. Yes, Marie.
I don't know how to say this, but we say a lot about this world is not our home. We're supposed to focus on there and everything else. But then when things do happen, even those in the church are like, "Oh God, why? I mean, I'm worshiping you." We still do it. Mm-hmm. It may not be even a conscious thing. Lack of faith, it's just you're so overwhelmed.
Yes, yes.
It's a conscious refocus, and that's very hard.
Yeah, that's a great comment. Yeah, it's not that one disbelieves in God, or that they believe that God is no longer who he claims to be in terms of being just and merciful and compassionate. I don't think Jeremiah questioned any of those things. In fact, he starts off, "Righteous are you, O Lord." You know, so we understand those things, but then there's, like you said, this feeling that comes up because of being overwhelmed that is part of being human, that human experience, right? And it causes us to go back to him again, back to his word, be reminded of what it's really all about. That's right. Yes, Judy. That's right. That's right. Even Jesus, he had that human side of him. That's how he could share in our weaknesses in this particular thing. And so when he had that opportunity, he said similar things as well. Right. Let this cup pass, but it's your will. It's your will. Good. Anybody else? Yes, Nancy.
Bad things happen to good people. So the whole story of Job God. He was close to God, and then bad things happened to him to show the world, you know, the nations, the right way to do it.
It does make sense, yes. Yeah. Good point. That's right. Though Job, you know, being human, would have said, I'd rather let this cup pass from me and let it be somebody else's. But God had confidence in Job. And that's what he told Satan, you know. Okay, you can have your way, but just don't touch his life, right? And so God had confidence in Job, and Job stood.
That should be the whole lesson in the book of Job. He lost everything that he did.
Yeah.
He stayed close to God. And when bad things happen to good people and Christians, that gives the opportunity for that person's life to shine for everybody else.
Yeah. Good comment. Yes, very true. Good. Anybody else? All right. So continuing on there in verse 3, Jeremiah is contrasting himself, kind of like Nancy was mentioning there, in light of the wicked. And of course, Jeremiah would also stand the test. He says, "But you, O Lord, know me. You have seen me, and you have tested my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter." So Jeremiah is saying, in contrast to them, you have seen me and you know my heart before you. Now, the end of verse 2, he says that the wicked, he says, you're near in their mouth, but far from their mind. And so this is a word that's describing in the Hebrew a very deep place within a person. Sometimes literally translated kidneys, but figuratively speaking about one's heart. And what he's trying to say is that these individuals, they might talk of you, but you're not close in their thoughts. They don't reflect on you and who you are and your ways. He's just doesn't have a place in their lives. He says that's how it is among the wicked. God just doesn't have a place in deep within their thoughts and their lives. But he says, you've tested my heart. You know, I can't stop thinking about you and your ways and what I ought to do and life to please you and to fulfill my work. And so he says, in contrast, you see deep within me, you know my heart. I'm not a hypocrite. So in essence, he's saying, why are you delaying? Turn the tables. Turn them now. Right? Remember verse 19 of the verse, chapter 11, the chapter before, 11:19, he says, but I was like a docile lamb brought to the slaughter. Okay, turn the tables. And he says there in verse 3 of chapter 12, prepare. He says, pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. He said, okay, you said you're going to do all these things. Why are we waiting? So again, it wasn't that he was questioning God's justice system or his character, but it was more of a question of he didn't like God's timing. Does that sound familiar? I think sometimes I can fall in that category too. Right? Kind of like Marie said, it's not a doubter and God or lack of faith in that regard. It's just, I don't understand right now. The time doesn't make sense. Yes.
We are not on God's time.
That's right.
How long was Joseph in jail? How long were the Israelites in the wilderness? How long were Peter and them all in jail? I mean, we are not on his time schedule.
Yeah. They're very true. That's right. Good. Anybody else?
We sing that song, Faith is Time.
Yes.
And I know I mean it when I sing it, but later it's hard.
Yeah, that's right. He knows our circumstances and our needs. He knows what happens before it happens. and will act when he knows action should be taken, whether that be speedily or slowly. And this is something that Jeremiah was going to have to learn, just like we have to learn. Isn't it interesting how it's true, like what James said about Elijah? He was a man with a nature like ours. All the prophets, they're just like us. And we're just like them. And we wrestle with a lot of the same questions. And there are examples to show that in the wrestling, we don't turn away from God, give up on God, but rather we turn to God stronger and be reminded that in our wrestling, God is aware of it, because all of these great men and women of faith in the past had wrestled all the same and stayed with the Lord. Any other thoughts? Okay, verse 4. How long will the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they said, he will not see our final end. And so Jeremiah is saying, in essence, that, you know, the land is even crying out because of the wickedness of the inhabitants of it. And he says, he kind of almost reveals what's in their heart, because they said, he will not see our final end. Now, it's really kind of impossible to know, are they referring to Jeremiah, that they're going to outlive and outlast Jeremiah here? Or are they referring to God, that as if God doesn't really exist, or God is not cognizant of their disobedience, and he's not going to see their final end? Either way, it just goes to show that they're haughty, arrogant, and proud, thinking that nothing terrible is going to befall them, and they're not able to be aware that Babylon's on the way. All right, so God's going to answer Jeremiah next, and we'll see how he begins to try and help Jeremiah with his internal wrestlings. So verse 5, he says to Jeremiah, if you have run with the footmen and they've wearied you, how can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace in which you trusted, they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? So here in this verse, he uses two figures of speech to Jeremiah, and they basically have the same message, a singular message. So let's just begin to break some of these figures of speech down. If you've run with the footmen and they've wearied you, how can you contend with the horses? Anyone got a guess at what God is getting at here? What's the illustration? Justin? Right, that's what he's aiming at with this figure of speech here. So I get it, Jeremiah. He says, you know, it is draining, but the race has just begun, really, right? It's discouraging to know that your own countrymen, your own hometown people, the men of Anath, are trying to hurt you. But he says, in essence, and we know this, how the story goes, Jeremiah's going to end up in prison at one time, right? Jeremiah is also going to, at another time, end up in a pit of mire, right? To be left to die there. And then, of course, as the story goes on, Babylon eventually breaks through the defenses of Jerusalem and begins to murder within the streets. And so the local heat from Anath was small into comparison to what was coming down the pike for Jeremiah. So what about that second one then? If you've in a land of peace in which you've trusted, they've wearied you, how are we doing the floodplain of the Jordan? What's the floodplain of the Jordan like? Anyone been over there to the Jordan? Justin, Nancy? Some of y'all?
You're helped a little here too, because in the cross-reference Bible, you have to have that, you might check out the center column, it mentions the word thicket.
The thicket, mm-hmm. Good, good. Jeff and Mike, I'm sure on your trip on the Appalachian Trail, there were some wide open spaces, easy to travel, and then some that had to wade through like...
thorns and thickets that you had to try to make your way through on some of those paths. You liked it when it was nice and wide.
Easier, right? Right in the land of peace going through. Yeah. Downhill is better than uphill. Right, right. And so one, you can go easily. The other one, slower, right? And like you said, probably have to stop sometimes and pick things off you and all of that. And so that's kind of what God is getting at with Jeremiah. You know, it's, I know it's kind of discouraging, but it's kind of a wide open path right now. It's going to start to close in on you, and it's going to be more slow going. Yeah. Anybody else? So this is what God is trying to get across to him. You're going to hang in there, Jeremiah. So both of these figures of speech were encouraging, hang in there, hold on. Because look what he says next in verse 6. For even your brothers, the house of your father, even they have dealt treacherously with you. Yes, they have called a multitude after you. Do not believe them, even though they speak smooth words to you. Ouch. There, you know, sometimes it hurts us when, you know, a friend at work, you know, says some bad things about us at, behind our back or something like that. But when you then learn it's actually your own flesh and blood, that cuts like nothing else. I mean, because you're supposed to be family. And God, in essence, is telling Jeremiah, listen, you got brothers, your father, I mean, they've dealt treacherously with you. And they're going to talk real nice to you in front. He says, but don't believe it, don't buy it. You know, they're talking with the neighbors. They're not so happy with you. And so this is going to be a trial to bear for sure. Anyone that's had family turn on them, it is a trial to bear. Justin, yeah, go ahead. Right, right.
Then it helps us in our life today to know that no matter what we're going through, whatever family problem, family strife is there, it's not anything new.
Yeah.
The heroes of faith of old have gone through similar situations as well.
That's right, that's right. Because some here have had family turn on them, say very harsh things. And it is a pain that's hard to bear. But Jeremiah, Jesus can relate. And I was thinking of Job, right? Because Job had some terrible losses take place to him, his family, and even his belongings. But it had to be so painful when he'd get discouragement from his wife, discouragement from his friends. And he said, miserable comforters are you. And so even Job had that pain of family turning on him. Can anyone think about what Jesus said about that? Matthew chapter 10, remember that famous verse there, Matthew 10, 34 through 39. There's Jesus said, "Do not think that I came to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I've come to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be those of his own household." So Jesus said that the gospel sometimes will do that, especially within a household, if there are some that love the truth and love Jesus and the others that don't. Then there's going to be a natural spiritual divide, and then man's enemies will be those of his own household. So what are we supposed to do? Verse 37, "Well, he who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And he who does not take his cross and follow after me is not worthy of me. He who finds his life will lose it, and he who loses his life for my sake will find it." He's saying, in essence, he's saying you're going to have to give up what you may want or desire, which might be that family peace, in the hopes that you'll gain spiritual peace with the Lord and for his cause. And the truth is, the Lord doesn't leave us orphans, right? Because then we find a spiritual family that can become our adopted family, a home away from home, right? And we find new friends, new family, to fill in that as best possible. But yes, the Lord knew that that could be a reality for individuals. It was a reality in our home growing up. But we're not alone. We know others had faced a similar thing as well, where the man's enemies become those of his own household. Any comments? All right. So, yes. Okay, Justin.
Getting back to the earlier part, though, to footmen and horses analogy, I like Proverbs 24:10, where the writer says, "If you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small." And I don't know if you remember this, but I can recall seeing that on your bulletin board like a long time ago. So we had that one over the years. Yeah. I would walk by and see that verse.
Good point. We must be related, because I had that reference written down over here as well, too. No, that's great. That's great, and that's true. And that's what God's trying to get Jeremiah to do, to hang in there, not faint or grow weary. So God now is going to turn his attention to himself so that Jeremiah might think about it from this angle. In verse 7, God says, "I have forsaken my house. I have left my heritage. I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies." So God, he's saying, "I know rejection, Jeremiah, like you know rejection." Even more so, right? I had to forsake my house, right? I had to give up my dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. And so I know, Jeremiah, what it's like to be hated by your family. Right? You know, we may have had a few fail us, but God had, in essence, all humanity let him down and turn against him. Do we give up or do we get up? Right? And that's where God is trying to encourage Jeremiah here. You know, I know what it's like for your dearly beloved to turn against you. You know, we don't stop to think about how pained God must be from day to day, right? When was the last time we've prayed, God, I hope you have a good day today? Right? We never stop and think about that. We often pray that we would have a good day, right? But He knows rejection. He knows heartache more than we do, because He loves all the world. And He has to witness the way the world has turned against Him 24/7. And so He's going to illustrate that very vividly in verses 8 and verse 9. Before we read those, any comments? Okay. So He says in verse 8, "My heritage is to me like a lion in the forest. It cries out against me. Therefore I've hated it." So He describes this beast of the forest, right? And it's roaring against Him. Right? And He says, you know, He's just tried to help it and assist it. And so He says, therefore I've hated it. In the sense of loved it less, right? It's not going to receive my favor. You see Him use that strong term in Malachi 1, verses 2 and 3, like that. Luke 14, verse 26, "Unless one hates his father and mother," right? He's referring to loving them less, not receiving His favor. Then He says, verse 9, "My heritage is to me like a speckled vulture. The vultures all around her are against her. Come, assemble all the beasts of the field. Bring them to devour." And so, vulture's not the most lovely of birds to begin with. It's not the most desired ones. And yet He said, even among them, she has become one hated among those, right? Like a speckled bird, right? Where the other birds recognize it's not a normal bird and they begin to attack it, right? Feeling it's like the ugly duckling. And so He's had to witness these things take place to His people because of their own sins, their choices that they've made, the direction that they've tried to turn. Even though He's warned them every single time, every fork in the road, choose blessing, not cursing. They just keep choosing cursing. And so He says, I've had to forsake my house. In some ways, withdraw from my house, right? That they might learn from their disobedience. All right. So our question, as we think about these verses that we've read, verses 5 through 9, think about how can this reply strengthen Jeremiah? How does this united reply to Jeremiah help strengthen him?
It's a reminder that it's not personal for Jeremiah, but it is personal for God.
That's great. That's a great... I didn't even think about that. That's a good one there. Especially since people weren't made in Jeremiah's image, right? They were made in God's image. He is the creator of all. And so people have constantly rejected Him day in and day out. But Jeremiah was just a spokesman for God.
Looking back at 5, where it talks about all that, it's kind of like God's given him practice. It's like you start to work out. You don't really want to work out, but you need to work out. So you've got this whole process that you're going through. It's painful. It's uncomfortable. It's not what you want to do. But it's building you, strengthening you for when the tougher stuff comes, or for new skills, and He's preparing him. And then He gets down here and He's saying, okay, you had a few people be upset at you, a few people that have really hurt your feelings, but I had an entire nation turn against me.
Right. So it begins to shift things. It should begin to shift things in Jeremiah's mind. Oh, I've had a bad, but I've not had it that bad, right? Yeah, good, Brandy. Anybody else? I mean, that really is the answer of how it strengthens Jeremiah. And we begin to, what's the old saying, walk a mile in someone else's shoes, you know? When we think about the infinite size of the shoes of God, all of a sudden our world becomes pretty small. We realize we're pretty small compared to what God has to manage and to think through on a continual basis. All right. So Jeremiah needed this strengthening. Now, God goes on in verse 10, many rulers have destroyed my vineyard. And so you think about like the shepherds, the elders, right, the rulers over his people. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. They have made it desolate, desolate. It mourns to me. The whole land is made desolate because no one takes it to heart. So he's saying they've just ruined it by their continual wickedness, their worshiping of foreign gods, idolatry, and evil living. And no one really is pained by it. No one takes it to heart. Verse 12, the plunderers have come on all the desolate heights in the wilderness, for the sword of the Lord shall devour from one end of the land to the other end of the land. No flesh shall have peace. So the enemies would come, they will pillage and attack and take the crops, all of these things. Verse 13, they have sown wheat but reaped thorns. They have put themselves to pain but do not profit. Be ashamed of your harvest because of the fierce anger of the Lord. And so he's saying, look, you know, you had these fake plans of peace. It was a phony peace. Peace, peace when there was no peace. And you got war, right? You sown wheat, but you reaped thorns. And you've put yourselves to pain for no reason. No profit out of it. So be ashamed of what you've reaped of your harvest because of the fierce anger of the Lord. And so God just adds on further how he sees what his nation has given themselves to and the consequences of that. So the last verses, 14 through 17, God kind of turns things a little bit here. And I think as I thought about it more today, I believe this ultimately is the answer to what Jeremiah asked at the beginning, right? When he says, let me talk about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are you giving them time? Why are you delaying and turning the tables? And so when we read this, it's not going to jump out at you right away, but I think it's the answer. So verse 14, thus says the Lord, against all my evil neighbors who touch the inheritance which I have caused my people Israel to inherit, behold, I will pluck them out of their land and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. Then it shall be, after I have plucked them out, that I'll return and have compassion on them and bring them back, everyone to his heritage and everyone to his land. And it shall be, if they will learn carefully the ways of my people, to swear by my name as the Lord lives, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then they shall be established in the midst of my people. But if they do not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation, says the Lord. All right, so Jeremiah, why am I so patient? Why am I not working on your time schedule? It's because I have a plan. That's what he's trying to get across to Jeremiah. I have a plan, you see, and you don't know all of it. You just see immediately what's right in your vicinity and what's happening in your life. But I'm thinking lifetimes ahead of you. And I'm going to remember mercy in wrath. Remember that's what Habakkuk asked? In your wrath, remember mercy. So yes, punishment's coming. These nations are going to come. They're going to smite my people. But those nations are also going to be plundered and smitten as well. And this really is borne out in the second half of Jeremiah that maybe, Lord willing, next year we'll get to. Like chapters 46 and 48 and 49, where he talks about Egypt being destroyed and then Egypt being restored. Moab being destroyed and then restored. And Ammon being destroyed and Ammon restored. And Elam being destroyed and Elam restored. What's he getting at with all of this? Well, it's his plans. Now, you remember the lesson I wanted you guys to get from this picture a long time ago? Right? The prophetic telescoping. You know, when something looks near, but it's actually far off. Like those Olympic mountains. They look right next to Seattle, and yet we know, right, Shannon? Pretty far away, aren't they? And so God here is sharing with Jeremiah, here's what I've got planned, right? And it might sound like it's nearby, but he's ultimately looking to the New Testament, the Messianic hope, right? Where they're all brought together in one, and then that one is my people. So look at that again now and have this in mind. Let's read it again, verse 14. Against all my evil neighbors who touch the inheritance which have caused my people Israel to inherit, right? So he's talking about those evil neighbors. You think about Ammon and Moab. Of course, Babylon's coming as well. Behold, I will pluck them out of their land and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. So I'm still going to keep my remnant people, right, through which the Messiah would come. Verse 15. Then it shall be, after I've plucked them out, that I will return and have compassion on them, bring them back, everyone to his heritage, everyone to his land. So God was going to have to do that to bring about the Messiah. Verse 16, and it shall be, if they will learn carefully the ways of my people, to swear by my name as the Lord lives. Right? So he's talking about that these foreign individuals learn actually the true God. And swear by him. And that, in essence, saying, declare allegiance to him. They're going to follow the one true God. As those foreigners had one time taught my people, he said, to answer or to swear by Baal. Well, then they shall be established in the midst of my people. Right? So God didn't have any specific covenant with the neighbors. But his promise was to also to bless them if they would obey. Foreshadowing the Gentile conversion, where all are one in Christ Jesus. This is fulfillment to that promise to Abraham. Through you and your seed, I'll bless all the nations. And so he's sharing Jeremiah here. Here's Jeremiah. This is why I'm not doing it on your time schedule. I got a plan. And it's going to take a while for me to get where I need to get. But we're going to get there. And so when you come finally to the New Testament, and look for example, a couple of passages in Romans. I know Rich is eventually going to do Romans, but we'll look at a few here. Romans chapter 9, verse 24 and 25. Romans 9, 24, 25. Paul putting those pieces together. He says, even us whom he called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles. As he also says in Hosea, I'll call them my people who were not my people, and her beloved who was not my beloved. So this is what God was talking about. They're going to be my people too. At one time they weren't, but now they are. And he would graft them in, chapter 11 and verse 20, where he talks about there as well. One more reference, Galatians chapter 3, 26 and 27. Galatians chapter 3, 26, 27. And there it says, for you're all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. When he says you all, he's talking about all of you, Jews, Gentiles, no matter your background. For as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And there's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free. There's neither male nor female. For you are one in Christ Jesus. So what Jeremiah was told by the Lord was foreshadowing that, pointing to that realization that would take place in the New Testament through the gospel of Christ. Okay, I had to kind of go through that quick. I'll do on Sunday like I did tonight. You know, we'll start off here again. If anyone had any additional pointers they want to add in or comments or questions, we can do that. But hopefully it makes sense and that you are also blessed to see that as I was in Jeremiah, the end of the 12th chapter. All right, so we'll go ahead and stop there and dismiss our class and pick up on Sunday, Lord willing. Mm-hmm.